so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, August 25th, 2017. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host, Jillian Walters.
Hi.
And Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
Guest co-host, Natalie Zaracco.
Hi.
And our control room operator, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
Welcome, everyone. Today's show is all about bats, often referred to affectionately as flying foxes. These incredible creatures get a bit of a bad rap, but they don't deserve it. Our first interview coming up in about 15 minutes is with biologist Mandy Kellner, coordinator of the BC Community Bat Program. She'll share some information with us about the bat species right here in our backyard in British Columbia and what we can do to help them. Our feature interview today is with Diane Odegaard, co-founder and director of the Austin Bat Refuge in Austin, Texas. The Austin Bat Refuge is dedicated to rescue and rehabilitation of bats, as well as educating the public and dispelling myths about these sadly oft-maligned animals. Diane has nearly 30 years of experience rehabilitating bats and other wildlife, and she's in high demand for speaking engagements and bat presentations throughout Central Texas. And that interview is coming up in just over half an hour, so stay tuned. But first, we have a special guest on the line locally. Can you tell us about that, Allison?
Yes, we have another Diane on the show right now for a special bonus little interview here. This is Diane Marsh. She is one of the founders of the Happy Herd Sanctuary in Aldergrove, BC, which rescues animals in order to give them forever homes. And Diane has a story to share with us. Diane, how are you doing today?
I'm not bad. How are you?
Oh, I'm actually really good today. I'm so glad we were able to have you on for this quick interview. Now, last weekend, something quite dramatic happened at the Happy Herd. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it starts 2.5 months ago. We took in 2 abused potbelly pigs from the SPCA from a seizure. And last Friday morning, went out and found 5 babies. So little piglets. One did not look healthy or look like it would survive at all. The other 4 were doing quite well. And so far, all 5 are doing well. Little Garth has not gained much weight. He's about 1.25 pounds at the most right now.
Wow.
And it's a trial every day with him. But the other ones are full of life and running around, and it's been exciting.
So if we could just backtrack a little bit, what was this, when you say seizure, what kind of a situation? And this pig, is her name is Lulu, is that right? And what kind of a situation was she from?
They were seized from Maple Ridge from people being evicted, and there were 17 dogs and the 2 pigs seized in a cruelty investigation.
Oh my God.
Wow. So this is what the Happy Herd exists for, is their SPCA was very lucky to be able to have you there. And yeah, so now you have 6 unexpected new residents at the sanctuary.
Seven.
Okay. Seven.
Yeah.
So I must understand, like, this must be a lot of work to take care of these baby piglets, and you are a nonprofit. What kind of help do you need from the community at this time to step up and pitch in to help with the situation that you're faced with?
Well, there's a bit more to the story, because on Monday morning, we didn't like the looks of Lulu and had the vet out right away. Couldn't find any indication as to why, but by the afternoon, she went downhill very rapidly, and we rushed her to the clinic, the Langley Animal Clinic, where Dr. Aaron x-rayed her and found a fetus inside the abdominal cavity that had pushed through her uterus wall. And had to go through emergency surgery and came home that night with a 50-50 chance of survival. So we had all 5 piglets in the house trying to bottle feed and nurse them. not knowing if the mom was going to survive through the night.
How is
she made it?
So she's okay now. So her chances of surviving are more than 50-50, I hope.
Oh, yeah. Now I'd say they're like 99.
Good.
So, and she's taken the babies back. She has the five of them most of the day. We still take Garth back to the house at night because it's, you know, of his size and the cold, and bottle feeding him in the house, you know, hourly. But everybody right now, touch wood, everybody's looking good.
Yeah, well, Garth is the tiniest little piglet I've ever seen, that's for sure. If people are interested in seeing photos, they can look up Happy Herd Happy Herd Sanctuary on Facebook, and Diane's actually been giving us lots of updates there on in videos and pictures of how the pigs are doing. So finally, we've got about a minute left here. Can you tell us how people listening can help these piglets in need?
Well, this is an unexpected expense for us. The surgery has been extremely expensive. I've had to rush Garth to emergency twice this week, and vets are here almost daily now. It was not budgeted for us, and, you know, we've also got to look at the fact that these five pigs are going to grow and could grow to be about 300 pounds each and are going to need housing and, you know, fenced areas and lots of food over the next, you know, 20 years. So we are not usually desperately asking for donations, but this is a very rare situation, and we could use some help right now.
Okay, so if people want to donate, I believe they can go to happyherd.org/donations to make a secure donation there. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and I already sent in my donation this week. So, and I actually hope to be able to help more, too. I haven't been out there for, it's been a year now. I'm due to go back, and you take volunteers, so.
Yeah, we take volunteers, and we try and do visits most mornings by appointment only, and are quite busy with that. And it's just a wonderful place to come. The animals are very loving, very friendly. Love attention.
It absolutely
Everybody's
is.
Everybody's happy.
Yeah. So I'm going to actually arrange a trip there, hopefully soon. So if any of my Animal Voices co-hosts want to come, Jillian's putting up her hand. Yeah, we will be there. So I'll be in touch with you soon about that. Take care. I know you have a lot to do, and I'll be in touch more in the future.
Thank you so much for giving us this time.
Okay, thanks, Diane. Have a good day.
All
bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
It's great. These pigs are so lucky to have people like Diane and Stephen.
Absolutely. If they didn't exist, the SPCA wouldn't have anywhere to take them.
That's
so
exactly, for sure. So, Jillian, you have some information for us on the new grizzly bear legislation.
Right. So it's not as exciting as it sounds. You know, the grizzly bear hunt is still going on this fall. That means 300 grizzly bears are going to be killed by hunters. And after that, hunters will still be issued tags. They can still kill grizzlies and take their pictures with them and take the meat home. They just can't take the other parts. So that's a huge loophole that we need to address. And I really encourage everybody to contact their local MLA, Andrew Weaver. It's public pressure is the only way that the hunt will finally stop. Actually, 90% of British Columbians are opposed to the grizzly hunt.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's it's pretty unbelievable that the legislation has loopholes like that. It seems like it's pretty easy to get around.
And trophy hunters. Really misleading the way that it was presented, saying grizzly trophy hunting is banned when a lot of grizzlies are still going to die, certainly this fall and possibly beyond that if we don't do something.
Absolutely. So yeah, right to your MLAs.
Right, and we have time to start the news now.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good.
All right. Well, in the news, I am sure you all heard about there was a farmer in England, in Wiltshire, England, who there was a barn fire last February, and a bunch of piglets were rescued from this barn fire, and these firefighters were praised for rescuing these 18 piglets and what I would assume would be their moms, two sows, and to thank the firefighters for saving the piglets, they sent the firefighters sausages made of the flesh of these piglets that they rescued. Wow. And thank you. Here's some organic sausages made out of the animals you rescued. So the fire station had made a post praising these sausages and saying, you know, like, oh yeah, you know, these are so great, definitely check out this farm. And of course there was some backlash. Yeah. because people are going, oh, you know, why would you tell us about their demise? Why would you like, why not let them live? But of course a lot of the people who are thinking this eat meat on a regular basis anyway, so definitely cognitive dissonance at its finest here.
Yeah, that's this a great story
example
was
of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, this story was unbelievable to me because you think about how often firefighters rescue companion animals like dogs and cats, and I mean, can you imagine somebody then making sausages out of a dog and feeding it to the firefighter who had rescued them? I mean, it's
exactly. When I was reading the article, I was thinking that if you just changed the word piglet to puppy, most of the world would be incredibly outraged.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the farmer's response, the fire station took down the post and apologized and said, oh, well, we didn't mean to offend anybody. The farmer responded saying, this is just what we do. We're not an animal sanctuary. We give the pigs the best opportunity and the best life they could have for 6 months. So, you know, like, thanks for letting me live 6 months and then killing me for something you don't need. Yeah, you know, I really appreciate it. It's, you know, you can't love animals and also farm and slaughter them like they're objects, and we have other things to eat, we don't need to do this. So so it's pretty absurd.
I honestly feel that if I had been one of the firefighters who rescued them, I mean, how can you look in the faces of these pigs and save their lives and, you know, kind of connect with them in that way and then later go on to eat them? I feel like there's an incredible disconnect there.
It makes me wonder if they had to do the deed themselves, if they really would rescue them and then kill them themselves.
Well, most people wouldn't.
The wording in their response to the sausages was weird. You know, exactly, they said, exactly 6 months and one day since we rescued 18 piglets from a fire, we got to sample the fruits of our labors from that night. And you know, so what, you rescued them so that you could eat them later. It's just, it's so disturbing, and also just indicative of our deeply entrenched objectification of animals. You know, they are they're seen as products, and they're bought and sold and killed like they're just resources for us, but we know they're not. They're intelligent and they feel, and they are deserving of more respect than that.
Absolutely.
Speaking of which, there is another kind of animal that has been in the news a lot this week. Fish farms have been in the news in the past few weeks, many stories. First Sea Shepherd has been teaming up with First Nations folks as well as fisheries biologist Alexandra Morton to capture footage of the conditions in fish farms here in BC. So earlier this month, they discovered wild fish trapped in salmon farm enclosures, which is obviously a problem. Mm-hmm. And this past week, they released disturbing footage of farmed fish suffering from deformities, open sores, among several other health issues. They're packed into these pens and swimming around in their own waste. Many of them are going blind. They say a disturbing number of them are going blind. And now we've just heard news from Washington of more than 300,000 farmed Atlantic salmon escaping their enclosure, and they're now swimming among the wild fish in the Pacific Ocean. So there are all sorts of ramifications to that situation. Mm-hmm. You know, ecological, obviously, but I've noticed that the narrative in the news has been focusing on the ecological impact of fish farming and how they're messing with wild fish populations and the surrounding environment, as well as the violation of indigenous rights that exists here. So those are very important, absolutely, but one thing that I think is missing in all these stories is the fish themselves. They're being talked about like they're vegetables, you know, but mm-hmm. But they're not. Fish are sentient, and this has long been proven by science. They feel things. They have lives and emotions. They've been shown to develop friendships with one another and even other species. Mm-hmm. They've even been found to exhibit signs of depression, just like your dog or your friend might when they're not getting something they need. So,
and we've done shows about this. If people are interested, go to animalvoices.org and look up our old shows there for fishes.
So please just educate yourself and just remember fish on that individual level. They deserve to be advocated for on that level.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sinead. So my first guest today is Mandy Kellner, biologist and coordinator of the BC Community Bat Program, a network of community bat projects across British Columbia carried out in partnership with the Ministry of Environment. Hello, Mandy, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi, Elise. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
For sure. So first of all, can you explain what a community bat program is and what these groups do?
Well, like you mentioned, we're actually a network of local bat projects. So some of the projects may be involved in habitat research or community work or a number of different things. And we've all gotten together to offer the Got Bat program. So we aim to provide information and in some cases assistance to private homeowners who have bats in their houses or want to attract bats or just interested in bats. We offer information to them. So by having a provincial network, we give consistent information across the province, and we're linked into lots of other professionals and bat biologists. So we're supported by veterinarians, public health specialists, and bat biologists. So we can access all these people to help us answer people's questions and provide support.
Excellent.
We deal with bats and humans, any sort of issues that arise.
Great. So Natalie has a question for you now.
Hi, Mandy. I was wondering if you could tell us why it is important to monitor and conserve bat populations in BC.
Yeah, well, bats are actually under a lot of threat from many different avenues. Bats are some of those creatures that are rarely seen, and there's a lot of myths about them. And unfortunately, some people tend to not like them when, in reality, they're totally a part of healthy ecosystems, whether you're in an urban environment or more rural or forest setting. Bats in BC are insectivores. They eat only insects. And they're huge consumers of insect pests, like the mosquitoes that might bother us in the summer, but they also, sort of more importantly, eat lots of forest and agricultural pests. So, in one study in 2011, the bats were estimated to save farmers $75 to $100 per acre of crops in terms of insect control. And a colony of 150 bats is estimated to eat 1.3 million insects a year.
Wow.
So the bats eating these insects, they're moving nutrients around the landscape. They do a lot of things that we appreciate. And they're under a lot of threat from human development and habitat loss. Wind farms have bat populations. Wetlands filling in, draining, is bad for bats for foraging and roosting habitat. And then, of course, there's white nose syndrome that I don't know if you're familiar with, but a devastating fungal disease.
Wow, yeah, that's amazing. So what are some of the most common bat species in BC and what's special about them?
Well, the species that we deal with the community bat program, the main ones that come in contact with humans in human houses, barns, or in bat houses, those are the little brown myotis, the Yuma myotis, and the big brown bats. Those are the ones most likely to have on your property. And all those are pretty cool in that they have managed to take advantage of the changes that we've made in the landscape. And they're doing quite well, and they might even have colonies having babies, you know, in your yard. So I think that's pretty cool about those particular ones.
Are any of the bat species in BC endangered or threatened?
Well, the little brown myotis that I just mentioned is currently one of our most common species, and it is actually federally endangered as of 2014. And that is because of the impacts of white nose syndrome out in eastern Canada. So this is a fungus that attacks the bats while they're hibernating and has sort of 99% mortality in winter. So we don't have that in British Columbia yet, but we're expecting it. And so, like I said, federally, that bat has now become endangered.
And unfortunately, that's something we are on the lookout for here. So that's a little brown mayotis. But beyond them, half of the 16 species in BC are at risk, which means they're considered vulnerable to become threatened or endangered.
Wow, I didn't know
so
that.
So none of them are doing that well. Yeah.
Yeah. So so this white nose syndrome, is this just something that bats catch from other bats, or do they catch it some other way?
Oh, that's a good question. The main way is from other bats because they're very sociable. Both in the wintertime, they'll be hibernating in groups, small groups in BC probably, but large groups in eastern Canada. And then in the summer, they're living in groups. So yeah, they can transmit the fungus between each other. But unfortunately, we think also humans can be a vector for it. So anyone who's working in a cave environment that has the fungus in it could carry it to a different cave environment. And recent research in the States also suggests that even in summertime, which last year we thought in the you wouldn't get the spores in the summer, they wouldn't be alive still, people are finding that maybe you can transmit them in the summer as well. So people may play a larger role in spreading white nose than we know.
Wow. So if a resident of BC discovers that they have a bat colony in their home or another building on their property, what are some of their options?
The first thing we'd encourage them to do is visit our website and send an email or call our 1-800 number, and then we can set you up with a regional coordinator for the program who is going to know the best sort of local advice. But in general, if the colony isn't coming in contact with where humans are living, we try and find ways that people can coexist with the colony. So we try and identify the main issue, whether it's guano or noise or whatever, and work with the landowners to find a solution, such as plastic sheeting or trying to keep the colony in one area of their house or attic space that isn't going to affect them. So that would be our first choice is coexistence with the bats. The other option is that you might want to exclude the bat colony from your structure. So in that case, we do have lots of research put into guidelines of when the best time is to do that. And that would be in the fall or winter after the bats have been, like the females are done raising their pups and they move out. You really don't want to do anything in the summer because you risk trapping bats inside your building. Obviously with nasty consequences. Mm-hmm. So, we have guidance on exclusion if people want to go that route.
Okay, and sorry, I just lost my train of thought. It is totally possible to coexist with these bats, as you said. And you mentioned earlier that they're mainly insectivores. They just eat insects. I think a lot of people have this conception that the bats bite or that they're dangerous to humans, and this isn't true, correct?
Well, like any wildlife, they do bite, and it does hurt. They do draw blood. And unfortunately, because a small percentage of them, like less than 1% in the wild, they do carry rabies, so any human interaction with bats needs to immediately talk to a public health professional and sort of assess the risk of the situation. But as I mentioned, like any wildlife, if you leave them alone, they're not going to come after you and bite you. They're just trying to do their thing and would rather not come into contact with humans.
Right.
So yeah, it's very possible to live with and not have any interactions and just know that you're having some insect control in your yard.
Good. That's good to know. So how can we and our listeners help make BC more hospitable to bats?
Oh, I think education and spreading the word that bats are actually really important and suffering from a lot of different threats is the first thing we can do. So raising awareness of habitat loss and how important it is to conserve trees, especially old trees. Bats in the wild roost under loose bark or in cavities in trees, so any sort of danger tree or snag could actually be bat habitat. So protecting those features, protecting wetlands, like I mentioned already, not using pesticides or trying to reduce use of pesticides is really important. One thing that the community bat program does a lot of is helping people with bat houses, so advising on the correct type of house for where they live, and it's also helping with installation to try and ensure that you're providing good quality habitat there, artificial habitat. So yeah, lots of things people can do.
Excellent. And are there any other ways that that people can create bat habitats or enhance the existing habitats?
Yeah, you can always make some snags if you're really industrious, I think. But more realistically is, yeah, installation of a pond or a bathhouse. And bathhouses can be made to look really smart and fit in a variety of situations. A single bathhouse can house up to 300 bats and provide a safe place for the females to raise their pups. So, yeah, that can have a huge impact. Like, bats live a long time. When one female could live 30 years, she's only having one pup a year. So making sure that those pups are safe by things like good habitat and also keeping cats indoors at dusk and dawn. Cats mm-hmm. are actually a big predator of bats. So, yeah, that would help bats as well in the province.
For sure. That's good to know. You've been doing this a long time. Do you have any interesting stories to share, any experiences that you've had with, you know, out in the field creating bat habitats or rescuing bats?
Not so much. I feel like it's nothing too crazy usually goes on. A lot of people are alarmed when they first call us and maybe have, you know, a bat injured or whatever. And luckily we're able to refer people to wildlife rehab centers, so I don't have to do the hands-on with the injured or troubled bats. But yeah, it's been really great just being able to point people in the right direction, I think, is more what I find really rewarding about the job. And yeah, knowing that you've helped some little bats and educate people about bats and the importance of them.
That's wonderful. So how can our listeners support or get involved with the BC Community Bat Program?
Well, we have lots of ways. We have regional programs, like I mentioned. So contacting your regional program coordinator might offer some awesome volunteer opportunities. We do an annual bat count every year in June, July, and we're always looking for people to help count at colonies. Reporting any bats you know of in a colony is the best way, really, that people can help out and be involved. And then also, yeah, if you're interested in initiating either a presentation or a bat house building workshop, the regional coordinators might be able to work with you to do that sort of thing. And financially, you know, we're always looking for donations as well, like so many different organizations I know. But through our website, we have a fundraiser where you can buy bat art. And we also have a link to donate if people are interested in that.
Wonderful.
But most of all, we just like volunteers. Come help us out.
For sure. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on Animal Voices today, Mandy, and sharing this information with us.
Yes, thanks for your interest in bats.
For sure. If you'd like to learn more about the community bat programs of BC or to get involved, visit bcbats.ca.
Tune in Thursday nights for Fruit Salad from 7 to 8 p.m.
Tune in to Fruit Salad. Tune in Thursday nights for Fruit Salad.
Who are those queer, trans, lesbian, gay people anyways? What is their agenda? Tune in to find out while they celebrate musicians, performers, organizations, families, writers, Pink World News, and much, much more.
But I feel the time has passed.
Fresh fruit every show.
Tune in Thursday nights for a show that's out of this world. Fruit Salad, 7 to 8 p.m.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
And now for some events. Tonight at UBC Robson Square, primate scientist Professor John Gluck will be giving a talk on his recent memoir, Voracious Science and Vulnerable Animals, A Primate Scientist's Ethical Journey. The book describes his time as a behavioral scientist who went from conducting cruel experiments on animals to recognizing them as individuals deserving of rights. at a time of unprecedented recognition of the intellectual cognition and emotional intelligence of animals, the book is a powerful appeal for our respect and compassion for those who have unwillingly dedicated their lives to science. Through the words of someone who has inflicted pain in the name of science and come to abort, it's important to know what has led us this far and where further inroads in animal research ethics are needed. So tickets to this talk are $25. All proceeds go to the work of Animals in Science Policy Institute. The doors are at 7 p.m., talk at 7:30, and again, that's at UBC Robson Square downtown. Also at Robson Square this weekend, tomorrow is the World Day for the End of Speciesism. Animal rights groups Direct Action Everywhere and PETA have planned a visual display that will make the public think about animal rights and speciesism. They are meeting at Robson Square, once again Robson Square Ice Rink, tomorrow afternoon at 12:30, and then walking to the protest location as a group. So yeah, 12:30 to 2 p.m. tomorrow at Robson Square. Also tomorrow, as every Saturday, Vancouver Chicken Save will be holding a vigil at the Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse at the corner of Hastings and Commercial. Do consider joining these wonderful people in bearing witness and spreading the message of kindness and compassion for the birds suffering behind slaughterhouse walls. They meet from 9 to 11 a.m. You can learn more on their Facebook page, Vancouver Chicken Save. And also this weekend, Surrey Chicken Save will be holding their bi-monthly vigil at Sunrise Poultry Processors. That's on 73A Avenue in Surrey. This is the largest broiler chicken slaughterhouse in Western Canada, with around 100,000 birds killed daily at just 35 days old, completely without necessity. The vigil will take place from 1 to 3 p.m. Rides can be arranged from the King George SkyTrain station at 12:30. And you can find more info on that on their Facebook page, Surrey Chicken Save. So once again, Vancouver Chicken Save tomorrow, Saturday at 9 a.m. Surrey Chicken Save is on Sunday.
And I just wanted to say as well, if people are listening, they're not quite sure what Chicken Save is, look on our website. We've done interviews actually as recently as this year with, we did an interview with actually John of Surrey Chicken Save, I think last year, and Megan of Vancouver Chicken Save this year, just several months ago. So go to animalvoices.org and you can find out all about the Save movement, which is growing hugely. Mm-hmm. And actually, being that I just got back from the National Animal Rights Conference, I found out we had Anita Crines there, who's the founder of the Save movement. People know her really well. Again, we've been talking about pigs. She was charged with giving water to pigs and charged with mischief, and that was dropped and just gained worldwide attention. And the Save movement has grown so exponentially, even just since this January. I can't remember the numbers, but there's like hundreds of groups now all over the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you want to be part of this movement, go to Surrey or go to Vancouver right here at Clark and Hastings, right?
Commercial and Hastings. Yeah, that's right, because that's where the Hallmark Chicken Slaughterhouse is. Yeah, it's so important to speak up for these birds who are being killed by the millions right here in our backyard. We actually did, not long ago, we did an interview with somebody from Toronto Cow Save.
For Animal Voices Cow Appreciation Day.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And that was a really moving, really incredible interview, just some of the experiences they had at bearing witness at those slaughterhouses. So check that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you guys going to any of the events? Going to see Professor John Gluck tonight? I think, Jillian, you're going, right?
I'm
going
to go.
I would like to. Yeah, it sounds like a really fascinating talk.
Absolutely. I'd be interested in reading the book as well.
And I'll be there at the PETA demonstration at Robson Square tomorrow.
Oh, right on.
That's Direct Action Everywhere, isn't it?
It's a combo.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
DXE
okay.
PETA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have any animal-friendly events that you'd like to have us promote on the show, then send us an email at animalradioanimalvoices@gmail.com or contact us through our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Perfect. My guest today is Diane Odegaard, co-founder and director of the Austin Bat Refuge in Austin, Texas. Diane has been a wildlife rehabilitator since 1990 and opened the Bat Refuge after working for over 12 years as education and public outreach manager for Bat Conservation International. Hello, Diane, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi there. Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So first of all, can you give us some background on the Austin Bat Refuge? When was it founded and what kind of work do you do there?
Right. We actually officially founded Austin Bat Refuge as a nonprofit at the end of 2015. But we've actually been doing this work for many years before that, since about 2006. And we did that under the mentorship of a few people who have been rehabilitating, studying, researching bats and bat behavior for many, many years. It's kind of a small, select group. There aren't a lot of people yet who do it, but some of the people who sort of pioneered it are Barbara Schmidt-French and Amanda Lawler and Susan Barnard, and so all of those people were very helpful to us over the years in learning, teaching us how to rehabilitate injured and orphan bats, and giving us lots of pointers along the way. So we, what we do here is we accept and rehabilitate injured, orphaned, and sick or displaced bats. There are a lot of different circumstances that bring bats to us, but the ultimate goal is always returning them to the wild. And alongside that, we also believe strongly in the importance of bat education, educating the public about the true nature of bats, and dispelling the incredibly negative mythology that still surrounds bats.
Wonderful. So how many bats do you currently have housed at the Bat Refuge, and how many different species are there?
Well, right now we have, in our flight cage, we have 43 bats of 8 different species. And all together we have 70 bats at the moment, and some of those are in the 43 are flying free and roosting free in our flight cage, and most of them will be released. The 20-some others are either in my non-releasable captive colonies. These are bats that came in with injuries too severe to be able to fly well enough to make a living out in the wild, or they are bats that are actually currently being treated for either injuries or having been found very thin and dehydrated, and most of those will eventually make it into the flight cage and with some luck out into the wild again.
Wow, that's amazing. So what got you interested in working with bats in the first place?
I'm asked that question a lot, and I think it was actually a number of different elements, but I think I'm actually temperamentally kind of drawn to animals that have PR problems, kind of an underdog approach. If I feel that the animals need more human help, then that seems to be the ones I'm drawn to. But with bats, it's so much more than that, really. It's just, there's some of the most fascinating creatures on the planet, and the fact that I was able to work with lots of bat scientists and conservationists at Bat Conservation International for so many years just got me really, really hooked on the science and conservation and the interesting facts about bats, most of which people are just completely unaware of, how much diversity there is in the world of bats and how long they live and how few babies they actually have, and elements that make it very important to try to protect bats.
Mm-hmm. We just had an interviewee on from the BC Community Bat Program. She was saying that some of these species can live up to 30 years. Is that correct?
Actually, the record, 30, I think, a little brown bat, which is one of the bats that has been hit very hard with a fungus called that causes the white nose syndrome disease. Mm-hmm. That I think that is a record about little brown bats. But the longest living bat, the record that we have for a little insectivorous bat, a little Myotis species, that was captured up in Siberia at the age of 41 years.
Wow.
So different species have different lifespans. There's quite a lot of behavioral and ecological difference among the different bat species, but they can live as long as 41 years, and that's pretty astonishing when you think about a bat living out in the wild for that many years. This was, we knew this because the people who captured this bat found a band that had been placed on this bat many years ago, so they had the information about where the bat came from and how old it was. So that was astonishing to the entire bat community.
That's incredible. Yeah, I've definitely learned something new here. So how do bats typically end up at the Austin Bat Refuge, and why do people bring them there?
Well, people find them in various places where they have either gotten in by accident, for instance, in a house, a residence or a business. Bats accidentally fly in sometimes at night if doors or windows are open. Sometimes they'll fly in because they're chasing a moth. Bats, of course, the vast majority of bats in North America are insect eaters. And so moths and other insects, of course, are attracted to light, and bats are not attracted necessarily to light, but they're very much attracted to insects. So they might fly into a building chasing a moth and then suddenly realize that they don't know how to get out. And that's, we find over and over again, that bats can get in, but they find it much, much harder to get out of a building. So that can happen also if the bat gets injured or disoriented because it's a young bat that is learning to fly. And somehow gets off course. A bat that's out in a storm accidentally might get blown into a building or blown down to the ground because they're tiny, tiny little animals that are usually extremely small and weigh very little. So sometimes they have broken bones. Sometimes they can get injured if something like that happens. Sometimes people, because of fear and because of stories that they've heard about bats, might actually try to hit them with something like a tennis racket or a broom. And bats have very, very small, fragile bones. And so we get a lot of bats in with broken arms, broken forearms, broken upper arms, or broken fingers, which are the bones that actually make up the structure of the wings.
Wow. So what does the process of rehabilitating the bats usually entail?
Well, it depends on the situation, and there are lots of situations. The first thing that it always entails is an examination where we examine how the bat's breathing. We examine its eyes for, any obvious problems that might indicate illness or pain or dehydration. We examine the body and the skin to see if the bat is dehydrated. We look at the belly to see if the bat is thin or emaciated. So we can get a pretty good idea there about the general health of the bat. Sometimes the bat comes in with parasites, with fleas and mites. Like any wild animal, they're subject to their own retinue of little ectoparasites, different mites and fleas that are mostly specific to bat species. So we can take care of all those things. We can even repair broken bones. And if it works right, it doesn't always work right, but if we get it right and if we have help from our vets with x-rays and some research into exactly what's going on, we might be able to even have a bat fly again after it heals. That's not always the case, but sometimes they can fly again, and very occasionally they can fly well enough to even be released. But if they're not releasable, then they have a home with us for their lifetime.
Oh, hi, Diane. This is Jill. Do you have any favorite stories? Hi. Do you have any favorite stories to tell from your rescue work over the years, or any individual bats who were particularly memorable?
Oh, you know, and again, there's so many. We've been doing this for a number of years, and so many are memorable. And one thing that we have discovered about bats, and it's not really surprising when you think about it, bats being mammals and really more like us than not like us, they're all individuals. So even within a species, there are lots of individual personalities. And, of course, all the different species of bats, and there are almost 1,400 species of bats worldwide. All the different species have characteristics that can be very different from one another. But we do have some favorites. We occasionally, almost every year in the summer, we'll get yellow bats in. The common name is northern yellow bats, and occasionally southern yellows. We're a little out of their range. But these bats actually roost in palm trees, in the dead fronds that hang below the living growth on palm trees. And they're about the same color as that sort of straw, yellowish straw-colored, dry palm fronds. So they roost in there, and it's good habitat for them. But they get in trouble sometimes because people will trim those dead fronds, and if they do that in the summertime, there's a good chance, if they're in the range of these bats, that they might be displacing some mother and pups. And so that's often why we get them in the summer. We'll get babies and mothers sometimes together. And we got a bat in, a bat and babies, a mother northern yellow bat and with three pups. Now, I said that, I think I said earlier, that most bats have only one baby once a year. They're slow to reproduce. But there are a few species of bats, often the ones that roost in trees, that actually can have as many as four babies once a year, all at once. And so the yellow bats are among those. And so we got a mother bat in with three pups that were nursing on her, and we got them all hydrated and fed up, and they lived in our flight cage and learned how to fly, learned how to become wild bats. The mother, of course, already knew, but the pups had the advantage of being able to fly in a safe place. And we had found out earlier, I think the year before, that there are some northern yellow bats roosting in palm trees here in Austin, Texas, which we thought might be a little north of their typical range, but they have moved into this area of the country, of Texas. So we knew that there were palm trees where yellow bats lived, and we were able to take those bats, the mother and pups, plus one single pup that came in and was kind of hanging out with them, trying to be part of the family. We released them in Austin into a palm tree nearby that we had gotten a yellow bat from before. So we were really excited about that, to actually see them fly off into the night and to know that they had a palm tree nearby that they might choose to roost in. It was a really, really satisfying a situation for us. And by the way, if anybody is interested in seeing pictures of some of the bats that I talk about, we have a blog on our website, which is austinbatrefuge.org, And if you go to the blog on the top of the homepage, and then you can search by bat species, you can see a lot of pictures and a little bit of text about the bats that we have rehabbed and often released. And there are several pictures of those yellows being released, and that was a really happy experience for us. And there are lots and lots of other stories. We've gotten some beautiful adult bats in that had some trouble for one reason or another and ended up on the ground, possibly because there weren't enough insects to eat, possibly because they got into some kind of weather trouble. You just never know. They'll end up on the ground. Someone will bring the bat to us, and we are able to be part of that wild creature's life just for the time it takes to get them healthy again, and then let them go. It's a really happy experience for us. It's a surprisingly emotional experience for both my husband Lee and I when we are able to release bats back to the wild after having this connection with them for a short or somewhat long period sometimes, especially the longer period when we get the babies in the early part of the summer. We have to raise them until they're actually able to fly and forage for insects on their own. So it's a long time, and to be part of those wild lives for that time is an incredibly special feeling for us.
That's so lovely. That must be wonderful. So what do you wish more people understood about bats?
Boy, I tell you, I really hope that people will understand that almost everything, generally speaking, that people think they know about bats is just wrong. The myths about bats are so pervasive. Even in a town like Austin, Texas, where I live, and that has an over 30-year mid-downtown bat colony of 1.5 million Mexican free-tail bats that have roosted under a bridge in the middle of town for over 30 years, and were known, of course, as the bat capital of the world, and all of the things that people use to market Austin because of the bats. Even in a town like this, people really often, we find, don't have a lot of real knowledge about what bats are like. And I think if people would realize that the benefits of having bats around far exceed any real or perceived dangers, and the dangers are more perceived than real. So I wish people would go to websites where there is good information. I really would like people to guard against the temptation to simply Google bats, bats and rabies, for instance, and find what is out there that is just often not true information. I'd like people to know that because bats are mammals, they can contract the rabies virus, but they don't carry rabies. So many people think that bats simply carry rabies without getting sick from it and dying themselves, and that's not the case. When they get rabies, they die from it like any other mammal, usually fairly quickly. And so bats are not all or even most rabid. The vast majority of bats do not ever get rabies. The other thing that people need to know is never take the chance of being bitten by a bat, because it's for the safety of the person and the bat. Because if a person is bit by a bat, which usually happens when somebody tries to handle a bat, they can be bitten, even though bats mostly are not aggressive. Bats, like any other wild animal, if they feel threatened, might bite. So if you get bitten by a bat and the bat flies away, then the person will almost certainly need to get rabies post-exposure vaccinations just to be sure. It's not that there's a great chance that that bat had rabies, but you just can't take a chance on a fatal disease. Now, if you get bitten by a bat that you still have in your possession, that bat really must be euthanized to be tested for rabies. And that's a very sad thing to have to do. We've had to do it a couple of times when people have brought bats to us. And even though we ask people to tell us every possibility for any human or pet contact, once in a while, someone will call back a couple of days or a week later and say, you know, I think I might actually have been bitten by that bat. And then the protocol is to euthanize that bat and test it for rabies, which is just a terrible thing for us to have to do. But we have done it, and we will do it again if we need to. But if people simply avoid trying to handle a bat and avoid being bitten by a bat, that doesn't ever have to come up.
Absolutely. Well, we are all out of time now, unfortunately, but thank you so much for coming on Animal Voices today, Diane, and sharing your knowledge and experience with us.
Oh, thank you. And please have people check out our website. We're also on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr. Please have people look, and if they have questions, they can get in touch with us, and we're always happy to answer questions about bats.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So for our listeners, if you'd like to learn more about the Austin Bat Refuge or to make a donation to support their work, visit austinbatrefuge.org. You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us here next Friday, September 1st. We'll have a show about dolphins for your listening pleasure. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website at animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows or download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook, facebook.com/animalvoicesvancouver, and on Twitter at animalvoicesyvr. We are currently looking for volunteers to produce, co-host, operate the control room, help with website maintenance and social media, and more. If you have skills and interest in any of these areas, as well as a passion for animal advocacy, please do drop us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Training will be provided. And now we'll leave you with a song. This is Peggy Seeger from her 1957 album of animal folk songs for children with Leatherwing Bat. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Hi, said the leatherwing bat, I'll tell you the reason that I fly by night. I've lost my heart's delight. Howdy-daddy-diddle-um-a-day, howdy-daddy-diddle-um-a-day, howdy-daddy-diddle-um-a-day. Hey, Lily, said the morning dove, I'll tell you how to regain your love. Quarter night, quarter day, never give her time to say your name. Howdy-daddy-diddle-um-a-day, howdy-daddy-diddle-um-a-day, howdy-daddy-diddle-um-a-day. Hey, Lily, howdy-daddy-o. Hi, said the robin as she flew. When I was a young girl, I had to. If one got just wanted to go, I'd have a new string to my bow. Howdy-daddy.